Richardson, who will deliver the Dell Grauer Memorial Lecture. This lectureship was established in memory of a remarkable man, former chancellor of this university, who left a lasting mark on the business and cultural life of this city and province. Professor Davidson was born in Springfield, Massachusetts, and grew up in Philadelphia and New York City. Educated in classics and philosophy at Harvard, Professor Davidson has been sometime chairman of the departments of philosophy at Stanford and Princeton, and a professor philosopher at Rockefeller University, before being appointed to his present post as university professor at the University of Chicago. He's been a visiting professor and lecturer in many parts of the world, Britain, France, Germany, Mexico, Sweden, Japan, Australia, South Africa, Finland. I can't remember all the countries, Don. He was a visiting fellow at All Souls and gave the John Locke lectures at Oxford and the John Dewey lectures at the University of Minnesota and the special university lecture at University College London. He delivered the Ernest Jones lecture for the British Psychoanalytical Society in London in 1978, and I understand his lecture tonight draws to some extent on that lecture. Professor Davidson is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a consultant of the National Science Foundation, an editor or consulting editor of many professional journals in philosophy and psychology. His work and publications touch on most of the principal areas in philosophy, including Greek philosophy, the history of ideas, logic, ethics, aesthetics, epistemology, and the foundations of the physical and social sciences. However, he is best known for his work in two fields, one comprising the philosophy of language and the theory of meaning, and the other, his more recent work, dealing with the philosophy of mental states, human action, and the free will. I think Dell Grauer, who himself had such a broad range of interests and to whom clarity of ideas was important, would have looked forward to hearing Professor Davidson talk to us on the paradoxes of irrationality. Professor Davidson.
Well, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here tonight. I've known Frank Loebweir for 30 years, but I had no idea what he was going to say. I'll just say it's always nice to meet old friends under circumstances where they have to say something nice about you. Whether justifiably or not, philosophers and some others, by and large, have been skeptical about the conceptual foundations of psychoanalytic theory. On the question whether psychoanalytic theory is a serious science, I shall have relatively little to say tonight. In itself, perhaps that's a question of relatively small interest until one decides what one means by science. If, in wondering whether or not psychoanalytic theory should be taken seriously, the point is only that any branch of psychology that deals with such matters as action, desire, belief, intention, motivation can never fully emulate the physical and biological sciences or be incorporated into them, as Freud hoped, then I'm in agreement with this. But if the idea is that the theories of Freud and his followers are radically unsuited to the phenomena that they're designed to illuminate and explain, then I think that the skeptics are, at least on some very important matters, wrong. Now I'm going to tell you about a true event which Ernest Jones used to illustrate a lecture which he gave in Toronto many years ago. Perhaps some of you know that Ernest Jones, after he studied with Freud, went to work in an English hospital, and he was thrown out of his job because he made the mistake of using the word sex in talking to a female patient. He escaped to other lands where he was more welcome and introduced psychoanalysis to Canada and to the United States. And it was in the course of doing that that he gave this talk. When he got to Toronto, he obviously wasn't quite sure what to talk about, but he'd seen an account in the newspaper about an event that was dramatic and, as he said, lent itself to some considerations of psychoanalytic interest. Here's the story, which he had read about in the paper. A young married couple were viewing the Niagara Falls from the ice that sometimes forms on the river beneath the falls. And suddenly the ice began to break up. And after the couple tried, against advice, to escape to the American side of the falls, the couple ran toward the Canadian shore. At one point, the woman sank down, crying, "I can't go on. Let us die here." But the husband and another man dragged her to within 3 yards of the shore. The remaining 3 yards were covered with soft ice, which the woman refused to cross. Although the river man, as Jones called him, showed that it could be done by twice crossing over himself. I'll tell you the rest of the story in Jones' own words. The woman declined to take the risk, and her husband refused to go without her. The mass of ice now began to drift down the river, breaking into smaller pieces as it went, and slowly but surely approaching the terrible rapids that lead to the Niagara Whirlpool. In an hour's time, they drifted to where a railway bridge crosses the ravine over 60 yards above their heads, and were on the point of being caught up by the swift rapids. A rope had been lowered from the bridge, and this was obviously their last hope of safety. As the ice flow, now moving rapidly, swept under the bridge, the man successfully seized the rope, but apparently the woman refused to trust to it. At all events, the man was seen to be vainly fumbling, with fingers numbed by cold, to tie the rope around his wife's waist. Failing in this in the short time at his disposal, before the flow passed onward, he flung the rope aside, knelt down beside the woman, and clasped her in his arms. They went thus to their death. Well, Jones speculates on why the woman might have failed to act so as to save herself and her husband. He rejects the idea that she was simply overcome by panic and fright, for, he says, psychoanalysts know that emotional paralysis is not so much a traumatic effect of fright as a manifestation of inhibition resulting from a conflict between a conscious and unconscious impulse. The conscious motive, to be saved, is obvious. What caused the conflict must therefore have been an unconscious desire for death. But, says Jones, the idea of personal death does not exist for the unconscious, being always replaced by that of sexual communion or of birth. We may thus imagine the woman as reacting to her frightful situation by rapidly transforming it in the unconscious and replacing reality by the fantasy of the gratification of her deepest desire. This tentative hypothesis, as Jones calls it, is strongly reinforced, or so he says, by the discovery that the couple were devoted to one another, had been married for 7 years, and were unhappy at being childless. Additional suggestions came from the association of Niagara with both suicide and honeymoons. And according to Jones, Niagara was then called the Baby City because of the high number of conceptions that dated from a visit there. Finally, Jones remarks that if the whole story were told to one as constituting a dream, one would have no hesitation in interpreting it as a childbirth fantasy of a sterile woman. Well, I take this example of psychoanalytic interpretation in the way in which Jones intended it, not as a substitute for the kind of carefully substantiated explanation that could come only with far more information, but as an illustration of how psychoanalytic theory may yield a startling and convincing insight into what otherwise seems a senseless and inexplicable piece of behavior. If Jones' speculation is right, the woman's behavior, her inaction, had a motive. In important respects, it was like intentional behavior, and as such, it was, of course, irrational in the extreme. Of the irrationality, Jones leaves no doubt. The external outcome of this act of transformation from the real situation into a fantasy of childbirth illustrates very well the contrast between the practical value of the pleasure principle and that of the reality principle. I realize that the theoretical background for Jones' explanation is not, or seems not to be, fully in accord with Freud's later doctrines. Apparently, the conscious and unconscious are treated here as quasi-permanent structures functioning more like the ego and the id of later theory. But the differences between these theories or different stages of Freud's thought, important as they are to any final evaluation of empirical accuracy and conceptual clarity, will not matter very much to my very general speculations. What are of concern to me are features common to very many, if not all, theories that have a claim to be called psychoanalytic theories. These features I'm going to list under four headings. Well, first, the mind sometimes contains two or more semi-independent structures. These structures being characterized by mental attributes like thoughts, desires, and memories, and capable of being influenced by and of influencing events in the other structures. Second, at least one part of the mind, which is less than the whole mind, is in many ways like a person. The various thoughts, needs, memories, and so on, combining, much as in intentional action, to cause further events in the mind. These events may be viewed as expressing the purposes or motives of the partial structure. Third, the various mental dispositions, attitudes, and events which characterize the substructures in the mind must be viewed on the model of physical dispositions and forces when they affect or are affected by other substructures in the mind. And especially important here is the thesis that the relations between the substructures are causal in nature. And fourth, last, some mental phenomena are not conscious. There are mental states and events that are, in other functional respects, like conscious beliefs, memories, desires, wishes, and fears, but they're not conscious. Now, it's obvious, I hope, even from what little I've said, that Jones' account of the dramatic Liebestod at Niagara makes essential use of all of these ideas. Yet it's just these ideas, even when they're stated in the very neutral way in which I've put them, that have seemed to many philosophers and others to be profoundly paradoxical, entirely unscientific, or even intolerably confused. The idea that the mind can be partitioned at all has often been held to be unintelligible, since it requires that thoughts and desires and various mental events be attributed to, located in, something less than, and therefore different from, the whole person. This is suggested to some people, for example to Sartre, that on such a view, the person himself cannot be held responsible for thoughts and deeds that take place in him. Indeed, that it becomes hard to decide when an act or a belief belongs to the person, as distinct from an act or belief that's just part of his mind or belongs to part of his mind. In theories like this, the critics say, segments of the mind are anthropomorphized. Even individual impulses are said to seek outlet or to be held at bay by miniature censors who contrive strategies to this end, while also, and unbeknownst to the agent, managing to conceal both original impulse and strategy from the agent or from the other parts of the mind. All of this is rather understandably held to be hopelessly confused. Now, in these last remarks, I've worked in a few puzzles that depend on the concept of unconscious mental events, particularly as these appear when combined with the basic assumption of a partitioning. But it's well to keep the ideas separate as assumptions. There could be unconscious mental processes without there being any fundamental cleavages along other lines. And there could be cleavages without the unconscious to help conceal the fact. Then there are the complaints that center on the third feature, either alone or in conjunction with others. Many object simply to the idea that explanations of psychological phenomena can be causal. They view causal and teleological explanation as modes of explanation that rule one another out. Still others worry that causal explanations must be backed by laws, while psychology, according to some of these critics, contains no strict laws. This was the view, for example, of Wittgenstein. Toulmin, Flew, McIntyre, and Peters, among philosophers, have at one time or another suggested that psychoanalytic theories attempt the impossible by trying to bring psychological phenomena, which require teleological explanation, that is, explanations in terms of reasons, under causal laws. This accounts for the fact, they've said, that in his confusion, Freud sometimes uses social or anthropomorphic metaphors in expanding his views and sometimes appeals to mechanical, hydraulic, or electromagnetic metaphors. Well, one way to judge the merits of these criticisms of psychoanalytic theory is to decide on some basis or other what we would demand of any good theory, and then evaluate psychoanalytic theory against these standards. This is a reasonable idea, but it's not to my present purpose. And part of the reason it is not is that I suspect that whatever differences we find between the methodology and accomplishments of psychoanalytic theory and the natural sciences, we're apt to find also between any branch of psychology that deals with intentional action, beliefs, motives, and emotions on the one hand, and the natural sciences on the other. An alternative approach, which is the one I plan to follow right now, is to try to arrive at a conception of the basic nature of irrationality using ideas that seem unavoidable in the description. Then I'll ask what would be required of any explanation of phenomena so described. At that point, we can look back to Freudian theory and ask which of its features are demanded by any theory that would do what it aims to do. The result, I'll tell you in advance, will be at least a partial defense of some important aspects of Freudian theory, just those aspects which I listed under those four heads. Well, according to Thomas Hobbes, only man has the privilege of absurdity. I guess I'll have to admit that he went on to say that of men, those are of all most subject to it that do profess philosophy. But, sorry. Oh, well. I take Hobbes' insight to be that only a rational creature can be irrational. Rationality is a necessary condition of irrational thoughts, behavior, and feelings. When this insight is properly understood, it will lead us to appreciate a basic tension in the concept of irrationality, or at least of some important varieties of irrationality, a tension that must be reflected, I think, in any attempt to explain irrational phenomena. To understand the nature of irrationality, then, I'm going to take a look at the concept of rationality in human thought and action. Of course, rationality can mean a great many different things, as can irrationality, but for the moment, it will be interesting to interpret the concept of rationality rather narrowly. Taken narrowly, rationality has two faces, one that looks inward and demands consistency, or the coherence of beliefs with one another and with desires, emotions, and intentions, the other that looks outward to the correspondence of feelings, action, and thought with the world. To illustrate what I mean by the neutrality of this reading of rationality, here are some examples. On a less neutral interpretation, many might hold that it's irrational, given the dangers, discomforts, and meager rewards to be expected on success, for any person to attempt to climb Mount Everest without oxygen, or indeed, with it. But I would not call it irrational in my sense, in a man who acted in the light of all the facts he could assemble, and after giving full consideration to all his desires, ambitions, and attitudes. At least under those circumstances, it would not necessarily be irrational for him. Nor should I be certain it was irrational to believe in astrology or flying saucers, unless, of course, such beliefs were unreasonable in the light of one's own evidence. Someone could quite sensibly try to square the circle, provided he had no final reason to think it couldn't be done. And I can imagine counting it sane to feel passionate love for a mouse, if the feeling was based on a reasonable conviction that the mouse had the soul of Cleopatra. I'm not sure what could reasonably produce this conviction, however. So the sort of irrationality that I'm talking about is internal, not due to mere failure on someone's part to share our values or convictions. Some of my examples here are static, concerning the relations among beliefs and other propositional attitudes. Others concern changes. Since I'm chiefly interested in the explanation of events, I'll concentrate on the dynamic cases, but very little generality will be lost as a consequence. Consider a simple intentional action. I'll take the one sensible actor in our little melodrama at Niagara Falls, the one that Jones calls the Riverman. The Riverman tried to save the doomed couple by showing how easy it was to cross the last 3 yards to safety. At one point, then, the Riverman did something rather daring. He returned from dry land to the treacherous ice. We know the intention with which he did this. It was to show the couple it could be done. This, in turn, he did, we assume, with the purpose of saving them. Given these intentions, we can infer that he had certain obvious beliefs. He thought the woman would be more apt to cross to the shore if she saw him do it, and he believed that if she did cross to the shore, the couple would be saved. Just knowing the intention with which he acted, therefore, provides us with an explanation of the action in terms of desires or purposes and of beliefs. It's as simple as this. He performed the action because he believed it would or had a chance of promoting an end that he valued. Now, I have, in fact, just given 2 examples of the most common sort of explanation of intentional action. The riverman crossed the gap because he believed it would encourage the woman to try, and he encouraged the woman to try because he thought it might save her. Of course, his crossing the gap and encouraging the woman to try were one and the same action, but these are two ways in which he conceived his action, and they require different, though closely related, explanations. This kind of explanation, with which we're all completely familiar, always explains an action in the light in which the agent himself saw it. Similar explanations are given for changes in attitude or belief. The riverman, we may suppose, came to fear for the safety of the couple when he noticed that they were on the loosening ice, since he feared for the safety of anyone caught on that ice. He came to believe they were in peril when he noticed the same fact, because he knew from experience that anyone caught on such ice was in peril. And we may surmise that if, contrary to the facts, he'd learned later that the couple survived their ordeal, he might reasonably have altered his conviction that no one could survive a passage through the rapids on a block of ice. These explanations of changes in behavior, feeling, and conviction show a common pattern. In each case, the change, described from the point of view of the agent, is seen as reasonable in the light of other cognitive and conative dispositions and events. The psychic compass is in each case small. In all my examples, two factors combine to explain a third. One change in attitude explains another when a certain belief is considered. A belief and a desire combine to explain an intentional action. More elements may, of course, be added to such explanations, sometimes almost without end. The explained event is made to look reasonable by being located in a suitable mental context. What makes the context suitable depends on two things. The desires and beliefs involved have, or may easily be given, a propositional content. And these contents are so related that the contents of the explaining factors provide logical grounds for accepting the contents of the explained factor. Thus, to repeat an example, the riverman believed that anyone on such ice was in peril. He noticed that the couple was on such ice and concluded that the couple was in peril. The propositions which form the contents of these beliefs are related as premises to conclusion. The second relation between explaining facts or events and the explained event is causal. The riverman crossed to the ice because he noticed that the couple was endangered. Seeing that the ice was breaking up caused his alarm because he knew or believed that such breaking would endanger anyone on the ice, and so on. Now, this form of explanation, which answers such questions as why did he do that? Why does he want so-and-so? Why did he come to think such a thing? Gives the answer in terms of causes that are reasons. The form of explanation is inseparable from the norm of rationality, since it explains something only by showing that it is, up to a point at least, a rational thing for the person to have done or thought. If this much is right, one line of criticism of psychoanalytic theory has already been refuted, for one criticism depended simply on the claim that reasons can't be causes, and that therefore no theory that attempts to explain mental events and actions in terms of both their reasons and their causes can be coherent. I've maintained, though hardly argued here, that the fact that an agent has reasons for an action or a belief cannot serve to explain the action or belief unless there's also a causal relation. So far from there being a conflict or paradox in a theory that combines these features, any theory that explains events as mental must have a causal dimension. I turn now to a form of irrationality, though one that we can describe and even partly explain without appeal to much more machinery than I've already introduced. I have in mind intentional actions in which the agent acts counter to what he believes is, everything considered, for the best. Aristotle called such behavior a case of akrasia or akrasia, and other popular terms are incontinence or weakness of the will, or for a nicer phrase still perhaps, Hare's phrase, backsliding. Let me generate an example from our Niagara tragedy. The husband's conduct, Jones says, and I'm quoting him, does not call for any special comment, being dictated by sufficiently obvious motives. Those motives are, I suppose, the husband's devotion to his wife and his determination to try to save her, at least until nothing more can be done. But Jones adds a jarring note by observing that the husband knew he was being watched by thousands of people, and that it would be difficult or impossible for a man to hold up his head again if he deserted any woman in such a situation, let alone his wife. Those were the days. I want you to imagine that the husband did act on this combination of motives, but that he did not believe these motives were good enough to outweigh the even plainer considerations on the other side. In short, he went against his own best judgment. In other words, he thought, sensibly, that it would be silly just to die for the sake of avoiding embarrassment. If we didn't already use the phrase in another way, I'd say it's foolish to die of embarrassment. The problem of explaining such behavior has puzzled philosophers and moralists, at least since Plato. In one of the Socratic dialogues, Socrates argues that since no one would willingly act counter to what he knew to be best, only ignorance could explain foolish or evil behavior. Socrates' view is paradoxical only because it denies what we all believe, namely, that there are incontinent actions. If Socrates is right, if such actions are logically impossible, then there's nothing paradoxical or even puzzling about the facts to be explained. Nevertheless, Socrates, or Plato, has brought our problem to a head. There is a conflict between our standard way of explaining an intentional action and the idea that such an action can be irrational. Since the Socratic view that no intentional action is irrational stands at one extreme in the spectrum of possible views, let me give it a brief name. I'll call it the Plato principle. It's the principle of pure rationality. In a way, we have at the opposite extreme what I'll call the Medea principle, the principle of pure unreason. According to this idea, a person acts against his better judgment only if an alien force takes over in place of his will. This is what happens when Medea begs her own hand not to murder her children. But her hand, or the passion behind it, is too much for her. She's overcome. In one way or another, this treatment of weakness of the will has been a popular one. And given the thesis, the term is suitable, for the will of the agent is weaker than the alien force. Moralists particularly have been attracted by this idea, since it suggests that no more is needed to overcome temptation than greater resolve to do the right. Nevertheless, it is a strange doctrine, since it implies that incontinent acts are not intentional, and so not in themselves actions for which the agent can be held responsible. If the agent is to be blamed, it's not for what he did, but because he did not resist with enough vigor. What the agent found himself doing had a reason, that is, the passion or impulse that overcame his better judgment. But it was not his reason. If it had been his reason, the act would have been intentional. but it was not, at least according to this view. From the agent's point of view, what he did was the effect of a cause that came from outside, just as if another person had moved him against his will. Aristotle, as so often, proposed a compromise. He thought that akrasia should be explained as a kind of forgetting. The akrates, the man who performs the act of weakness or shows weakness, the akrates has two desires. In our example, he wants to save his own life when it's clear that he cannot save his wife's, and he also wants to avoid what might seem a cowardly act, particularly before a huge crowd. He can't act on both desires, but Aristotle won't let him get so far as to appreciate the dilemma that he's in. According to Aristotle, he forgets or loses active touch with his knowledge that he may save himself by clinging to the rope. It's not quite the case of a conscious and an unconscious desire in conflict. Rather, there's a conscious and an unconscious piece of knowledge, where action depends on which of the two is made conscious. Now, I'm sure that there are situations in which Aristotle's analysis is appropriate, though it's not very easy to imagine that someone in the husband's situation might forget for one split second that he mightn't be able to save himself by clinging to the rope. And there are cases that are surely ruled by the Medea principle, when it's appropriate to say that someone was carried away by passion. But these cases are not the only ones, and logically and psychologically, they're not the most interesting. They're none of them cases where an agent acts intentionally while aware that, everything considered, a better course of action is available. Yet this is the case that seems most troublesome to explain. We get more insight, I think, if we reflect that neither the Plato principle nor the Medea principle nor Aristotle's analysis can allow for straightforward cases of conflict. By a straightforward case of conflict, I mean a situation in which an agent has good reasons both for doing and for refraining from the same action, or what comes to the same thing, good reasons for doing each of two things where both cannot be done. Yet surely such situations are too familiar to require special explanation. We're not normally paralyzed when conflicting claims are laid on us, nor do we usually suppress part of our information or drive one of our desires underground. Those things happen, but they don't have to. Most of us can face cases where a decision must be made, and we decide best when we manage to keep all the considerations, the pros and the cons, before us. What requires explaining is the action of an agent who, having weighed up the reasons on both sides, and having judged that the preponderance of reasons is on one side, then acts against this judgment. We should not say that he has no reason for his action. Of course he does, since he has reasons both for and against. It's just because he has a reason for what he does that we can give the intention with which he acted. This kind of action, unlike Medea's, is intentional and need not be confused, frantic, or unconsidered. And like all intentional actions, it can be explained by referring to the beliefs and desires that caused it and gave it a point. Nevertheless, the action was irrational. Although it was done for a reason, the agent had better reasons by his own reckoning for acting otherwise. What needs explaining is not why the agent acted as he did, but why he went against his own knowledge or opinion that the action was not for the best. There's a logical point here that I have to dwell on just for a moment. It's often been thought that the basic model for practical reasoning, reasoning about what it would be good or right or desirable to do, is syllogistic in form. So we might imagine our embattled husband reasoning. It's undesirable to do something that will make me seem a coward and a cad, but if I save myself while letting my wife drown, I will seem a coward and a cad. Therefore, it's undesirable to save myself. Now, attractive as this simple model is, it can't be right. For the young man is also in a position to argue from even better premises to the conclusion that it's desirable to save himself. Yet true premises cannot lead to contradictory conclusions. Now, the solution to this puzzle is simple, and it's absolutely fundamental. The maxims of action on which people act can't be of the simple form I imagined. It isn't always undesirable to do something that will make you seem a coward and a cad. Sometimes it's the only sensible or courageous thing to do. And it isn't always desirable to save your own life, though of course it is if there aren't better reasons against it. Avoiding disapproval, saving one's life, having children, demonstrating to someone how they may escape peril, all of these are simply reasons for or against acting, reasons good enough in themselves, but bound to come into conflict with other reasons on occasion. In matters that require us to weigh up competing reasons, deduction can take us only so far. When the reasons have been mustered, we weigh them up and decide. Logic alone can seldom dictate the best answer. The trouble is, the incontinent man recognizes that the weight of the argument is on one side, and yet he opts for the other. His error is not strictly a logical one. His deliberations lead him to conclude that on the basis of all the reasons he ought to do A, but he likes B better and does it. His faulty action corresponds to a judgment, if we please, a judgment that B is better than A. And this is logically consistent with the conditional judgment that A is better than B on the evidence. Logically consistent, but not consistent. For there's a principle of rationality, the principle of continence, that says a rational man acts on his own best judgment, on what he thinks is best, all things considered. A purely formal description of what is irrational in an acratic act is then that the agent goes against his own second-order principle, that he ought to act according to what he believes is best, all things considered. It's only when the action is described in just this way, as going against his best judgment and the principle of continence, that there's a puzzle about explaining it. Clearly, any explanation of the action that allows a description of the action as irrational must introduce a causal element that does not supply a reason. The cause may, of course, be plausibly confused with or associated with another mental event or state, which, were it the cause instead, would yield a standard explanation. Then the actual cause might indirectly provide a degree of explanation that would depend on its description as a feature of the mind. But there cannot be a causal sequence, no matter how complex or devious, that corresponds to a course of reasoning satisfying the Plato principle. For if there were, the action would not, after all, be irrational, and its explanation would pose no theoretical problem. The concept of irrationality we've been considering applies directly only to intentional actions, but it can be extended in natural ways to a far wider field. In close analogy to incontinent action, there are beliefs we form on the basis of reasons or evidence, but where, in our own opinion, there are better reasons to believe something else. Here again, the explanation of our belief, the reasons we or others could give for why we believe what we do, must include a causal factor that's not a reason. Many desires and emotions could be characterized as irrational in a similar way, and in each case, it would be easy to show that an explanation would have to contain a non-rational cause. The general concept of irrationality also applies to unchanges. A person is irrational if he's not open to reason. If, on accepting a belief or attitude on the basis of which he ought to make accommodating changes in his other beliefs, desires, or intentions, he fails to make those changes. For he has a reason which does not cause what it is a sufficient reason for. It's not yet apparent why the explanation of irrationality poses a problem. For after all, why should we hesitate to appeal to a mental cause that is not a reason? To trace out the difficulty to its source will bring us to the second major paradox of irrationality. If events are related as cause and effect, they remain so no matter in what vocabulary we choose to describe them. Mental or psychological events are such only under a manner of description, for these very events surely are at the same time neurophysiological or ultimately physical events, though of course recognizable and identifiable in explaining mental events by appeal to neurophysiological or physical causes. This is what we do when we explain perception, for example, where events in the external world cause us to form beliefs. And it's what we do when we explain memory, for there also, of course, events in the outside world cause us to have beliefs. But if the cause is described in non-mental terms, then we necessarily lose sight of what we wanted to explain, namely the element of irrationality. For the irrationality springs from the failure of the cause to be a reason. And cause and effect fail or succeed in their logical relations only when described in mental terms, as constituting thoughts, memories, intentions, or desires. The irrational can be identified only as an aberration of the psychological. Events viewed as merely physical or physiological cannot be judged as potential reasons or as conflicting or as concerned with a subject matter. Thus, the idea of a mental cause that is not a reason generates a paradox. If we think of the cause in a neutral way, by disregarding its mental status as a belief or emotion, we think of it merely as a force of some kind that works on the mind without being identified as part of it. Then we fail to explain the irrationality that we set out to understand. And if we hold to the mental description, which at least makes it a candidate for a reason, then we depart from the only clear pattern of explanation that applies to the mental, for, after all, it isn't a reason. There's an obvious way in which mental events can cause other mental events without being reasons for them. This happens, without paradox, if the events occur in two different minds. If the riverman had succeeded by his brave demonstration in getting the threatened husband and wife to save themselves, the thoughts and desires in his head would not be the reasons on which the couple acted. But they would be causes, since they would have caused the riverman's performance, which would in turn have caused the thoughts in the couple that caused their behavior. Mental phenomena may cause other mental phenomena without being the reasons for them, then, and still keep their character as mental, provided cause and effect are adequately segregated. The obvious and clear case is that of social interaction involving two or more people, but the idea can be given application to a single mind and person. If we're going to explain irrationality at all, it seems we must assume that the mind can be partitioned into partly independent structures that interact in ways that the Plato principle cannot explain or allow. To constitute a structure of the required sort, a part of the mind must show a larger degree of consistency or rationality than can be attributed to the whole. Unless this is the case, the essential analogy with social interaction is destroyed, and the concept of irrationality will again lack application.
Each part of the mind must be more like a rational mind than the whole mind is. Here we may usefully recall the analysis of akrasia that I offered. There I mentioned no partitioning because I offered no explanation, only a description. But the description could be justified or made intelligible by supposing two agencies, one that found that a certain course of action was, all things considered, best, and another that acted as if that judgment had not been made. On each side, the side of the sober judgment and the side of the incontinent action, there was a supporting structure of reasons, of interlocking beliefs, expectations, assumptions, attitudes, and desires. To set the scene in this way still, of course, leaves much unexplained. For an application, we still want to know why this double structure developed and how it accounts for the action taken, and also, no doubt, for its psychic consequences. What's important is that the partitioned mind leaves the field open to such further explanations, for the immediate conceptual tension between the demands of explanation and the description of what was to be explained has been dissipated. Allowing a degree of autonomy to provinces of the mind dissipates to a degree the problems we've discussed, but it generates others. To the extent that the Plato principle fails to explain the workings of the mind, mere causal relations replace it. And these explain best or make most progress towards science as they can be summarized in laws. But there's a question how far the workings of the mind can be reduced to strict deterministic laws, at least as long as the phenomena are identified in mental terms. For one thing, the realm of the mental cannot form a closed system. Much that happens in it is perforce caused by events that have no mental description. And for another, once we contemplate causal relations between mental events in partial disregard of the logical relations between the descriptions of those events, we enter a realm without a unified and coherent set of constitutive principles. The concepts employed must be treated as hermaphroditic, owing allegiance partly to their connections with the world of non-mental forces and partly to their character as mental and directed to a propositional content. These matters bear directly on the important question what kind of laws or generalizations will be found to hold in this area, and therefore on the question how scientific a science of the mental can be. But this is a subject I've put to one side. There's one other problem that springs from recognizing semi-independent mental agencies within the same person. We attribute beliefs, purposes, motives, and desires to people in the endeavor to organize, explain, and predict their behavior, verbal and otherwise. We describe people's intentions, their actions, and their feelings in the light of the most unified and intelligible scheme we can contrive. Speech yields no more direct access into this scheme than any other behavior, since speech itself must be interpreted. Indeed, speech requires two levels of interpretation, there being both the question what the speaker's words mean and the question what the speaker himself means by speaking them. Not that an agent knows directly what he believes, wants, and intends in some way that reduces observers to mere detectives. For though he can often say what's on his mind, his words have meaning only in the public domain. What his words mean is as much up to the interpreter as to him. What makes interpretation difficult is the multiplicity of mental factors that produce behavior and speech. To take an instance, if we know that in speaking certain words, a man meant to assert, well, say that the price of plutonium is rising, then generally we'd have to know a great deal about his intentions, his beliefs, and the meaning of his words. If we imagine ourselves starting out from scratch to construct a theory that would unify and explain what we observe, a theory of the man's thoughts and emotions and language, we should be overwhelmed by the difficulty. There are too many unknowns for the number of equations. We necessarily solve this problem by a strategy that's simple to state though vastly complex in application. The strategy is to assume that the person is to be understood as much like ourselves. That is perforce our opening strategy, from which we deviate only as the evidence piles up. We start out assuming that others have, in the basic and largest matters, beliefs and values similar to ours. We're bound to suppose that someone we want to understand inhabits our world of macroscopic, more or less enduring physical objects with familiar causal dispositions. We're bound to suppose that his world, like ours, contains people with minds and motives, and that he shares with us the desire to find warmth, love, security, and success, and the desire to avoid pain and distress. As we get to matters of detail, or to matters in one way or another less central to our way of thinking, we can more and more easily allow for differences between ourselves and others. But unless we can interpret others as sharing a vast amount of what makes up our common sense, we will not be able to identify any of their beliefs and desires and intentions. The reason is the holistic character of the mental. The meaning of a sentence, the content of a belief or of a desire, is not an item that can be attached to it in isolation from its fellows. We cannot intelligibly attribute the thought that the price of plutonium is rising to someone who does not have many true beliefs about the nature of plutonium, about prices, the nature of price economies, and so forth and so forth. One attribution rests upon the supposition of many, many more. Among the beliefs that we suppose a man to have, a great many must be true, at least in our own view, if any of them are to be understood by us. The clarity and cogency of our attributions of attitude, motive, and belief are proportionate then to the extent to which we find others consistent and correct. We often and justifiably find others irrational and wrong. But such judgments are most firmly based when there is the most agreement. We understand someone best when we hold him to be rational and sage, and this understanding is what gives our disputes with him a keen edge. There's no question but that the precept of unavoidable charity in interpretation is opposed to the partitioning of the mind. For the point of the partitioning was to allow inconsistent or conflicting beliefs and desires and feelings to exist in the same mind, while the basic methodology of all interpretation tells us that inconsistency breeds unintelligibility. It's a matter of degree. We have no trouble understanding small perturbations against a background with which we are largely in sympathy. But large deviations from reality or consistency begin to undermine our ability to describe and explain what is going on in mental terms. What sets a limit to the amount of irrationality we can make psychological sense of is a purely conceptual or theoretical matter. That is, the fact that mental states and events are constituted, the states and events that they are, by their location in a logical space. On the other hand, what constrains the amount and kind of consistency and correspondence with reality that we find in our fellow men and women is the frailty of human nature. The failure of imagination or sympathy of the interpreter, the stubborn imperfection of the person who is to be interpreted, these are what stop us from finding other people perfectly rational, perfectly right. The underlying paradox of irrationality, from which no theory can escape, is this. If we explain it too well, we turn it into a concealed form of rationality. While if we assign incoherence too glibly, we merely compromise our ability to diagnose irrationality by withdrawing the background of rationality needed to justify any diagnosis at all. What I've tried to show, then, is that the very general features of psychoanalytic theory that I've listed as having puzzled philosophers and others are, if I'm right, features that will be found in any theory that sets itself to explain irrationality. The first feature was, you may remember, that the mind is to be regarded as having two or more semi-autonomous structures. This feature we found to be required to account for mental causes that are not reasons for what they cause, the basic source of irrationality. Only by partitioning the mind is it possible to explain how a thought or impulse can cause another to which it bears no rational relation. The second feature assigned a particular kind of structure to one or more subdivisions of the mind, a structure sufficiently similar to that needed to explain ordinary intentional actions. This calls for a constellation of beliefs, purposes, and affects of the sort that, through the application of the Plato principle, allows us to characterize certain events as having a goal or intention. The analogy does not have to be carried so far as to demand that we speak of parts of the mind as acting or thinking. What is essential is that certain thoughts and feelings of the person be conceived as interacting to produce consequences along the principles of intentional actions, these consequences then serving as causes but not as reasons for further mental events. The breakdown of reason relations defines the boundary of a subdivision. Though I talk here with Freud of parts and agencies, there does not seem to be anything that demands a metaphor. The parts are defined in terms of function, ultimately in terms of the concepts of reason and of cause. The idea of agency is not one that requires a little agent inside our ego or id. Again, the operative concepts are just those of cause and of reason. The third feature on which I remarked was that certain mental events take on the character of mere causes relative to some other mental events, a fact reflected in many places in Freud's writings. But this feature also we found to be required by any account of irrationality. It's a feature that can be accommodated, I argued, but only by the partitioning of the mind. The fourth feature, the claim that many mental phenomena are not conscious, is one about which I've said very little. The reason I have not is that I think the most pressing objections to the unconscious are answered by answering the other objections. It's striking, for example, that nothing in the description of akrasia requires that any thought or motive be unconscious. Indeed, I criticized Aristotle for introducing something like an unconscious piece of knowledge when this was not necessary. The standard case of akrasia is one in which the agent knows what he's doing and why, and knows that it's not for the best, and knows why it's not for the best. He acknowledges his own irrationality. If all this is possible, then the description cannot be made untenable by supposing that sometimes some of the thoughts or desires involved are unconscious. If to an otherwise unobjectionable theory we add the assumption of unconscious elements, the theory can only be made more acceptable, that is, capable of explaining more. For suppose we're led to realize by a genius like Freud that if we posit certain mental states and events, we can explain much behavior that otherwise goes unexplained. But we also discover that the associated verbal behavior does not fit the normal pattern. The agent denies he has the attitudes and feelings we would attribute to him. We can reconcile observation and theory by stipulating the existence of unconscious events and states, which, aside from awareness, are like conscious beliefs, desires, and emotions. There are, to be sure, further paradoxes lurking here, but they seem to be paradoxes that result from partitioning. Unconscious mental events do not add to the paradoxes, but are natural companions of them. I've characterized irrationality in terms of its cause. Irrationality has a mental cause that is not a reason. This is a necessary condition for the irrational, but is it also sufficient? Well, that depends on what you count as irrational. For there's a form of self-criticism and reform that we tend to hold in very high esteem, and that has even been thought to be the very essence of rationality and the source of freedom. Yet if I'm right, it is a case of mental causality that transcends reason. What I have in mind is a special kind of second-order desire or value and the actions it can touch off. This happens when a person forms a positive or negative judgment of some of his own desires or of his own personality, and he acts to change these desires or these features of his personality. From the point of view of the changed desire, there's no reason for the change. The reason comes from an independent source and is based on further and partly contrary considerations. The person has reasons for changing his own habits and character, but those reasons come from a domain of values extrinsic to the aspects to undergo change. The cause of the change, if it comes, can therefore not be a reason for what it causes. A theory that could not explain irrationality would be one that could not explain our salutary efforts and occasional successes at self-knowledge and self-improvement. Thank you.
I think we have time for a few questions. If you could.
Dr. Davis, what do you think of a man that during the fire they squirted gasoline on his face and his hands before he got to the fire?
What do I think of a man who in a fire thinks first of saving his stamp collection and then of saving other people?
Instead of it, right? And then of his wife.
Oh, and then of his wife, yeah. Well, I distinguish between making a moral judgment of such a person, which of course ought to be negative, and judging the rationality in the special and rather restricted sense in which I was discussing rationality. If such a man really does set a greater value on his stamp collection than on his wife, if this value is consistent with the rest of his values, if he has thought about or realizes what the consequences of choosing one of these courses of action over the other is and so forth, then he's a cad, but he may perfectly well be rational.
Yes, madam.
I have a feeling that there are two different questions here. The first one was, I've talked about irrationality on the part of individuals, but how about social irrationality, irrationality in social behavior or social arrangements? It seems to me that a completely different set of considerations enter when we talk about irrationality there. And there are many kinds, of course, of social irrationality. Some of them can be parts of institutions. Institutions can themselves be irrational in the sense that they actually contain contradictions. Certain methods of voting or of reaching social decisions, for example, can be such that they lead to contradictions or undesired consequences or unworkable consequences. And there are many other forms of social irrationality. Your second question was, if I have it quite right, what should we say about someone like Hitler and his policies and so forth? I excluded irrationality that just consisted of people having values or thoughts which are very different from the ones that we prize. By excluding that, I didn't mean at all that we don't ourselves have plenty of reasons to disagree with them, to condemn them, to hate them, to defeat them in any way we can, and so forth. But such people don't necessarily have any internal conflict. There may not be any sense in which their various ideas and purposes conflict with one another. And that's the kind of irrationality that I thought there's a real puzzle about explaining. I'm not sure that there's any puzzle about explaining the sense in which, let's say, Hitler was irrational, because that's a matter of showing something terribly wrong in his values. That's not puzzling, though it may involve a completely different sort of consideration.
Yes, yes, sir.
After saying some polite things, the questioner says, isn't it really the case that psychoanalytic explanations satisfy us because they're always ex post facto, and we feel as though we're getting an insight, but this is an insight that's provided only after the event? And perhaps there's something deceptive about that. I should perhaps have emphasized more than I did, but now I'll take the opportunity to point out that, of course, there are a great many aspects of psychoanalytic theory which I was not defending at all. I said absolutely nothing about things that Freudians consider to be quite essential, and namely the etiology of neuroses and psychoses, the origins of mental difficulties in childhood, the emphasis on sexual causality and so forth. I said nothing about any of that. I didn't even say anything about the number of parts of the mind that we should expect to discover or how permanent they would be. So most of the interesting details of Freudian theory, which go into the kind of analysis that you're talking about, were not part of what I was discussing. I was discussing some very general features, which in themselves have been considered to be wrong-headed, confused, especially the combination of causality and teleological explanation that one finds in Freud. And I thought it was interesting if one could see that there isn't anything wrong with that much anyway, because, after all, that is essential to all psychoanalytic theories.
If there are no more questions, I'd like to ask Dr. Donald Brown, professor of philosophy at UBC, to thank Dr. Davidson.
Professional philosophers as one of the most original and one of the most hard-headed, the one of the most formidable of the practitioners of analytic philosophy. It's particularly gratifying to me that such a representative of contemporary philosophy could be found as tonight discussing matters which are of lively interest to any thinking person, and placing them in the kind of general perspective which people have always asked philosophy to provide. So I'd like to thank him on behalf both of my academic colleagues and of the thinking persons present for an extremely stimulating and valuable evening.
Thank you very much. Next week, our speaker will be Donald Seller, who is the Washington correspondent for the Southern newspapers, who will speak on the new administration. And then after that, on the 24th, we will have Lord Diplock from the House of Lords speaking to us about law in the 80s. So I urge you to, there's still time to join the Vancouver Institute. We're grateful for your membership and support.